A new study published by DCU has found that cervical cancer screening is more effective with increasing rates of HPV vaccination. I'm joined on the line now by the lead author of that report, Dr. David Grimes. He's Assistant Professor in Biomedical Physics at DCU. David, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm not too bad at all. So on the face of it, I think most people hearing that headline would be somewhat confused as to how cervical cancer screening is improved by vaccination uptake.
Well, I suppose to clarify a little bit, technically, almost all cervical cancers are caused by HPV infection. So as we vaccinate more and more people with the very successful screening program or the vaccination program we've had here, that should reduce in less cervical cancers during people's lifetime and eventually the eradication of them. Now, screening has to evolve with that, and there are different approaches to screening. Some listeners may be familiar with LBC, which is the cell-based cytology versions that we had.
Yeah.
And now we have HPV reflex screening, which essentially tests if someone has HPV infection as well. And what we found in this study is that if we pivot towards those methods, which Ireland has, and that tends to have a very good outcome for screening. So screening still remains very effective as long as we are using these newer HPV-mediated modalities. And that's really positive, given that that's kind of the direction we've taken on it.
And I would imagine in other countries they have a different experience. They may not, as you say, have pivoted towards the newer method of reflex screening. But to what degree is the improvement? Can you quantify it?
I suppose to quantify it like this, if you stayed with LBC screening, which is the old standard, and as HPV vaccination rates increased and cervical cancer became increasingly rare, and the cells that lead up to it became increasingly rare, you would be far, far, far more likely to get a false positive, which would require invasive kind of investigation or colposcopy and things like that. So the real benefit we see here is that it is not now, but it's going to be 50 years in the future.
Yeah.
Which is what we have to kind of think towards. As you point out, a lot of countries have started making these calculations. We didn't expect the HPV vaccine to be so effective when it was released. It has been incredibly effective. By 2040, cervical cancer will be eliminated in Australia, which is one of the first countries to take it up, virtually gone. And Ireland can go that way too. But we still need to have a screening program that can catch people that were too old to get vaccinated and to make sure that no one needs to die from this terrible disease. And I think that's the real positive message here.
And that is also a key point. Taking the HPV vaccination is limited to very specific age cohorts. And if you're over that age cohort, you can't obtain the vaccine, which means that even if it weren't as effective as it was, and the screening would have to continue in order to cater to those age cohorts who weren't lucky enough to be in a position to receive it.
Absolutely, and there's always the reality that vaccination is highly, highly efficient, but it's not infallible. Occasionally it doesn't work. So we're still going to need to have some kind of screening program on board in order to deal with that, and we need to future-proof that as well. And I think the study today that was released basically says exactly that, that this is very future-robust, and that between screening and increased HPV vaccination, we can eradicate cervical cancer in maybe the foreseeable future in Ireland, which is fantastic.
That's a really exciting prospect.
Absolutely, and it's not just cervical cancer. HPV is responsible for 5% of all cancers worldwide, including an increasing amount of head and neck cancers, particularly in young men, and obviously penile and anal cancers as well. Again, we've rolled out HPV vaccination for boys in Ireland, and I think we can all look forward to a future where people do not need to die from HPV-mediated cancers. That's incredibly aspirational, but really I think it's where we can get to.
Now, I know that your research has concluded that the system that's currently in being in Ireland is robust. Are there ways in which you think it could be improved?
The way I think it could be improved the most is by more engagement from the public with it. One of the biggest problems is people miss screening, or they may be, and it's uncomfortable, it's intrusive, and obviously people want to sidestep it. I think from the medical professional side, if we can show people this is not always that bad and is very, very beneficial, and if we have more engagement from the public as well, I think that will really plug that gap, if it makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. David Grimes, Assistant Professor in Biomedical Physics at DCU and lead author of that report, thank you indeed for joining us. Now, a new study by Thresholds, its tenant sentiment survey for this year, shows just one in four people who are currently living in rented accommodation have done so by their active and conscious choice. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by John Mark McCafferty. He's Chief Executive of Threshold. John Mark, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Kira.
I suppose I want to be clear at this from the outset, because when I tweeted to say that you were coming on, we got a response saying only 25% by choice. They don't have any other choice, as they probably wouldn't get a mortgage. But these are people who maybe, given their stage of life or otherwise, have chosen to rent, this one in four.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a group, usually it's younger renters, you know, so students and young adults who are choosing or opting to rent. Now they would have limited options otherwise. The other options probably if staying at home, if you know, with family, with parents. However, I guess what we found, and it's confirmed what we've seen before, is that as the National Housing Charity assisting and advising private renters across the country, over half said that they rent because they're unable to buy their own home. And I guess the news here is that, you know, in years gone by, you know, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, a generation ago, people would have moved from renting, or a larger group of people would have moved from renting into home ownership. And the age at which someone would buy their first home would be a lot kind of younger, a lot lower than it is now. And so we're seeing, you know, a larger private rented sector relative to the other, you know, either social housing or owner occupation. So the private rented sector is growing compared to what it was, say, 25 years ago, 40 years ago. Also, people are staying in the private rented sector a lot longer. Now, that wouldn't be a problem if you had affordable rents and if you had high quality stock across the board and if people felt secure in their homes. But that's not the case. And while we found that over 60% wish to own their own home within 5 years, only 30% expected that they would be able to. And a lot of that is tied up to the fact that they're spending so much of their income on rent, they can't save. And with the, you know, the rules in terms of mortgages, they're frozen out of owner occupation. And we know that house prices are escalating as well alongside rent levels. So it is a very challenging scene facing many renters.
I think that historic concept of that you alluded to, Mark, John Mark, of renting being a transitional phase in an adult's life has had a massive impact on how Ireland as a society and the housing market in particular views renters. That kind of concept of transitionality has dictated the manner in which leases are set up and constituted, let's say, with reference particularly to the continent, where you can get leases of 99 years, not so here, because we assume you're going to be doing this for a couple of years and moving on. It has, I suppose, in many ways dictated the relationship between landlord and tenant, and also the kinds of homes that are available and the number of homes that are available to renters.
Yeah, I suppose, I think the private rented sector in Ireland was viewed as a kind of a form of purgatory. That once, you know, you left school or you left college or university, you would do a kind of a period in purgatory known as the private rented sector, and you would then become part of the virtuous property owning democracy, and you would own your own home, and only those, and such as those who hadn't the wherewithal or the capacity, you know, or for all sorts of other reasons that people might judge, would remain in this kind of purgatory of the private rented sector.
And then everybody could happily look down on them.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reality is that, you know, the private rented sector is here to stay. It's growing, both in real terms and in relative terms. And I know, you know, there's some landlords that have left the market, but generally, if you look at kind of over the last 25 years, it really has grown substantially. And there's a broad variety of people in there in terms of individuals, families, older people, an increasing share of older people. And you know, families are rearing their home, their children in the private rented sector. Some through choice, but you know, the vast majority, as we've found, different in terms of our sample and their clients that we've assisted and advised, not through choice. And I think it's important to say that, you know, less than half felt secure in their rented home, according to our research, and that nearly 90% found it difficult or extremely difficult to find a secure home in the private rented sector. So it shows that there's a huge gap between people's aspirations and their expectations, as well as a lack of faith, if you like, in the ability of the current housing system to meet with those expectations. And the findings, you know, in the findings, the vast majority of renters aged over 24 would prefer not to rent, and that is really quite stark. And as renters, private renters do get older, the cost and the long-term insecurity that they face is a real challenge for their quality of life and ultimately for Irish society. So we are at a bit of a crossroads right now in terms of, you know, a huge shortage of affordable housing. You know, there's just a lack of affordable housing to either buy or rent. And most of the clients that we work with in Threshold just don't see a future that gives them what they need or gives them what their families need.
Does the announcement today by, or rather in the early hours of this morning, by the Housing Minister that he is going to cap rent increases and rent pressure zones, which coincidentally includes the entirety of County Kildare, and align it with inflation, would that have any impact, John Mark, on people's feelings of stability or lack thereof in their rented home?
It will assist things. It is positive and we welcome it. One of the things that we were calling for as a result of this research was an increase in affordable housing, and that part of that is about supply, but it's also about rents that are more affordable than they have been. I guess the issue is, if the rents were already high and unaffordable, setting them then to just, you know, 1% or 1.5%, 2%, because inflation could be increasing, means that's 1% or 2% of a much higher rent. So rents aren't coming down. They're still going up, and especially they're going up in places like Kildare, places outside of Dublin, you know, commuter counties. And that continues to be a real challenge for individual people and for families. So it is welcome. You know, if you link it to inflation, it will be lower than the 4% increase of the rent pressure zones up to now. At the same time, what we need is the deliberate building and supply of affordable rental housing. So alongside a ramped up supply of social housing, and further availability of owner-occupied housing, there's, if you like, it's almost like a new tenure or a group within the private rented sector, which is housing provided at genuinely affordable levels. And there was an announcement a couple of days ago, kind of almost hand-in-hand with this rent pressure zone announcement, around affordability and what that means. You know, affordability is more like 250,000 for a house.
Yeah, I remember the relatively recent announcement as to what constitutes affordability in various parts of the country. And if I remember correctly, the concept of an affordable home in Dublin was somewhere in the region of €450,000, which would mean you'd need two people earning about €100,000 each in order to be able to obtain a mortgage to get that. That's about as affordable now as it is for me to buy a McLaren F1.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, it assumes that everyone works in like the tech sector or our senior management in the financial services or law or something. I mean, so it's a reflection on kind of the society we've kind of created. And I think affordability remains a huge issue. And while, as I say, it's positive that further increases will be very, very modest, The rent levels are already at a very, very high level. And that's why supply is really important. And that's why security of tenure is really, really important. And one of the things that our research found that, you know, the tensions do arise within tenancies. Not always, it's not inevitable, and it's only in a small number of tenancies. But where they do happen, they can have a really negative impact on the prospects of a tenant remaining in that property. I mean, one of the things we saw was that, it could be easily assumed that, say, a tenant who's rented from a landlord for an extended period of time would be more likely to have a positive relationship. But our research seems to suggest that it appears that tenants who have been renting for longer may be regarded as more seasoned and more likely to challenge their landlord, and that often negatively affects the relationship. We did a piece of research with Dr. Michael Byrne recently as well, which shows that landlord-tenant relationships are prone to deterioration once the tenant takes some kind of action to address an issue, standards and repairs, an unfair rent review, and the risk of an issue arising increases the longer the tenancy is in place.
Which all speaks to the behaviour of one set of parties in that particular relationship.
I guess there are good landlords.
Absolutely. Yeah. And as you've said, John Mark, the proportion of landlord tenant relationships that break down to such a degree are thankfully quite small.
Yeah.
But if you have a situation where people are saying that veteran tenants are more seasoned and more likely to challenge, or that a relationship between landlord and tenant can deteriorate when issues are raised by the tenant with the landlord, there's only one party there that could stop that happening, and it's not the tenant.
Yeah, and look, there is an inequality of arms here. You know, in the private rented sector, the landlord has more power than the tenant. There's no question of that. And so where relationships turn sour, the landlord has more options at their disposal in terms of ending a tenancy. You can end the tenancy after 6 years. You can end the tenancy if you're going to sell the property or if you're going to do very substantial renovations. Now, the renovations or the changes would need to be very substantial and very specific, but still. Or if a family member wishes to move in. So there are a number of kind of key grounds in which someone can lose their home through no fault of their own. There's also what we found in that research, a high rate of churn, and that lack of stability means that many individuals, many families can't, place their roots in a community or don't necessarily have the confidence to invest in a location and in a community if they're worried about losing their home. They are less likely to challenge a landlord on things like standards, repairs, a boiler needing fixed, or a cold, damp home, because if they fear that if they raise their head above the parapet, there may be implications in terms of a rent increase or some kind of tension, some kind of dispute. That is an ongoing worry, and that has all been exacerbated by COVID-19 and this whole narrative around staying at home, cocooning at home, working from home. So, those of us who are fortunate enough to own our own homes and to maintain them to standards, we're in a much better position to begin with in relation to COVID-19 than to tenants who maybe had a very precarious situation where the house was less than ideal, but standards and repairs were poor. And that has all been magnified, especially where people are at home 24/7, maybe with long-term illnesses. So that is an added kind of a tension, I guess, for a lot of private renters.
Well, John Mark McCafferty, Chief Executive of Threshold, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, the Heads Up programme, and we'll be talking about Ireland, the substance that is Ireland's biggest drug. Now, more people are using illegal stimulants, smoking less, and binge drinking remains high. That's according to a new report published today by the Health Research Board after surveying close on 6,000 people. 7% of those surveyed have used illegal drugs in the last year, and men aged 25 to 34 are most likely to report cocaine use within the course of the last 12 months. The study does, however, show that alcohol remains Ireland's effective drug of choice. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line now by Head of Communications and Advocacy at Alcohol Action Ireland, Eunan McKinney. Eunan, you're welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara. Thanks for having me on.
Delighted to do so. I would imagine on a purely statistical basis, any study in pretty much any country in the world, but not all of them, in which you examined substance abuse, alcohol is always going to come out on top.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously, alcohol is a legal drug, essentially, and all the others that are featured in this report, like heroin and cocaine and all the others, are largely illegal. I mean, obviously, there is a whole sort of other layer of benzodiazepines, etc., that are, quasi-legal in some respect, and, that's a longer conversation. But you're right, absolutely. You would find that alcohol is by far the biggest preferred drug in most Western European countries, anyhow, that would be the case. But I think what we see in this report, you know, just in the context, to put it in the context for some people, you know, we know that from the survey, the data from the survey, they're estimating somewhere around 200,000, 290,000 people have used illegal drugs over the last 12 months in Ireland. But by comparison to alcohol, 2.9 million people have used alcohol in that over the last 12 months. And in that in itself, that's nearly 3 million people. Mm. Over half of them have a hazardous relationship with alcohol.
And that perhaps is the key point, because, I mean, I drink very rarely, but if I had taken part in that survey, I would have had to said, yes, I have had something to drink over the last 12 months, I think maybe on two occasions. But it's the problematic relationship with alcohol that is the key point here. And I still think that most people don't understand how to self-assess whether or not their relationship with alcohol is problematic.
Yeah, and again, there's a very interesting, I mean, this is a really very interesting report, and it's going to take a long time for us to digest it. The 100 pages of really hard data and core information, so it'll take some time. But there is a section in the alcohol area where they do talk about people's understanding of their own use of alcohol. And, you know, the HRB, the Health Research Board, has consistently brought this issue to policymakers' attention, is that we consistently, as individuals, underreport what it is that we are drinking. And so, you know, you do find that there is a misassessment of it. And of course, fundamentally, you know, what we do have as well is that people, sadly, you know, we somehow don't understand, or perhaps we don't want to understand, that the actual harm that alcohol is doing us. And so when we have a discussion about having low-risk guidelines in relation to alcohol use, in other words, what would you safely perhaps consume alcohol at as an individual on a weekly basis? And people decry at the low levels of which it's involved, thinking that somehow or another that anything beyond that is just completely nanny-state stuff. Mm. But the reality is that alcohol is a drug. It's a psychoactive substance. It's killing 2,700 people in Ireland annually. And we have, you know, our hospitals are full of people in relation to, you know, sadly, alcohol-related illnesses, you know. So there's a real gap here between people's, A, the level of alcohol that they are actually using on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, but also really, really big gaps in relation to people's understanding of the harm that it's causing them.
And that cognitive dissonance, really, Eunan, is perhaps the point at which any solution or resolution to this will be found. Because at some level, most people, not all people, but most people know, whether they acknowledge it to themselves, that, you know, if they're drinking too much, they are aware of it. And then there is a choice as to whether or not to continue. I'm speaking clearly in not abusive relationships with alcohol,
sure,
just in the vein of general consumption.
Yeah, no, sure, and I understand the point you're making, but I would counter it slightly by saying that, you know, in fairness to people, I actually don't believe we do tell them what the harm of alcohol is sufficiently. I mean, we do, obviously, as a small organisation, an NGO, a charity-based organisation that's trying to push a rock up a hill, so to speak. But in the context of how much money is actually spent on alcohol advertising, marketing and promotion in Ireland versus how much money is spent on alcohol prevention and alcohol awareness, you know, the ratio is somewhere around 400 to 1 in terms of the spend. So is it unusual that people don't understand the risk? Or is it unusual that people aren't aware of the risk? No, I think not, because I think what we're fed in relation to alcohol marketing and the curiosities around drink is that, you know, we're always told about the joyful aspects of this, but we're never explained as a society about the harms.
But then there's a separate and related question, which is somewhat philosophical in nature, Eunan, would be how much influence would you imagine that 400 to 1 spend on alcohol advertising and marketing will have on person X's? They're sitting on their couch on a Wednesday evening saying, sure, I'll have another can.
It's absolutely huge, because what it is it pervades. Like, we talk all the time in Ireland in a kind of an excusing way and a sort of a understanding way that somehow or another we throw our hands in the air and say that, well, sure, look, we have a culture of alcohol in this country, so what can we do about it? But the reality is that we don't particularly have a culture of alcohol. What we have is a fabricated culture around alcohol, which costs about $115 million a year to maintain. And so, you know, we have to make the connection between the marketing of the product, the absolutely tsunami wave of alcohol marketing which we experience in our day-to-day lives, and this notion that somehow that we have an innate culture. We don't have an innate culture as such. What we do is we have some historical issues around alcohol because of our gene pool and everything else. But in terms of the culture which we have today, which essentially allows alcohol to accompany us from the cradle to the grave, that is a fabricated culture that costs the alcohol industry an awful lot of money.
Well, Eunan McKinney, Head of Communications and Advocacy at Alcohol Action Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us. Is Eunan right? Do we have a fabricated culture of alcohol? Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. Brand new programme is being launched in Northwest Kildare specifically for men. To tell us all about it, I'm joined on the line now by Sinead O'Kane. She's Wellbeing and Resilience Coordinator of this joint programme between Heads Up and County Kildare Leader Partnership. Sinead, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hi, Kira. Thank you so much for having me on.
Delighted to do so. Tell us about this programme, who it's for, and what you aim to achieve.
Great. So, as you said, the programme is called Movement on Kildare. It is a side project from Heads Up. It's run by County Kildare Leader Partnership. But the main thing with it is it's aimed at men who are the ages 18 plus who live particularly in Northwest Kildare. These are, like, we all know that the last few months have been very difficult, with especially due to COVID. People have been struggling, maybe they're isolated, maybe their moods kind of dip down. So, you know, a lot of people have become disconnected.
Mm.
So we're just, the whole point of the service is to get men, you know, to support men. So a guy will come and identify that he needs a bit of support. I will have a chat with him, see what's going on. He'll tell me what's happening and what he's interested in doing. So most people want to, you know, get connected more back into the communities, or maybe whether that's joining a men's shed, or maybe that's getting a job, or maybe it's getting something of for to boost their confidence.
Yeah.
Maybe going to a class. So it's, someone comes in, it's very community based, so it's a free service. Like, it's a non-medical service. And it's very much the men who tell me what they want to do. We have a chat about what they'd like to do, and together I try to support them, and we kind of come up with options. So a lot of the time we kind of think, you know, I ask guys, what did you used to like doing? And what are you interested in? And what would you like to do? So we kind of work around there. So the men very much are, it's the men tell me what they want, and we work together. And if there's something they're not interested in, they don't do it. Very much they have the power and choice in this.
And I would imagine, Sinead, that this is very much a bespoke service, in the sense that some people might need greater support than others in, you know, reconnecting with their local community.
Definitely. And I offer one-to-one support in itself for it depends on how long the person needs that support level. And I usually do a follow-up to them anyway, because I'd be connected with them for a number of weeks. And then if they do choose to go on somewhere else, I'll connect in with them to make sure they're happy. And if not, we can look at them that and reconnect in. I'm also running workshops in a line with one of the men's sheds. We're hoping to do one in Kyle Dove.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be looking at the perks of the outdoors, really. So that we're doing, that's going to be we're going to do a trial workshop there in about, I think it's the 28th of July is when we're saying.
So we'll, just a couple of weeks away, really.
Yeah, just a few weeks. So hopefully that can branch out, because that'll be the pilot one we can branch out. But at the moment I'm working one-to-one, whether it's on the phone, whether it's on Zoom, or I am meeting people in social distancing manners outside, and whatever the man feels comfortable with, basically.
And Sinead, if any men listening would like to find out more information or would like to engage with the programme, how can they do that?
Yeah, well, look, if you're a man or you know a man who fits this category, maybe it's your friend, maybe it's your partner. My own number is 086-77-02-907.
And I'll give out that number again before the end of the programme. Wellbeing and Resilience Coordinator Sinead O'Kane, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking about parental alienation. Now, we're going to discuss parental alienation. Now, alienated children first. For people who aren't familiar with your group and what it is that you do, you're seeking to shine a very, very bright light on the concept of parental alienation. And you've also described it as a crisis and recently commended Women's Aid for their highlighting of concerns of parental alienation. And I know when some people hear that phrase, they won't quite understand how insidious it can be for one parent to turn a child or children against the other, whether in the context of relationship breakdown or otherwise.
Yeah, it's anathema, isn't it? You would think that it's just such a no-brainer. Minister Helen McEntee describes it as a situation when a child's resistance or hostility towards one parent is not justified and is the result of psychological manipulation by the other parent. I mean, that's what she called it in the Dáil in July 2020. Like, psychological manipulation of a child to dislike its own parent? I mean, how can it be anything but absolutely wrong? And where we support Women's Aid so much is that, of course, we are both totally against any kind of domestic violence. Mm. And this is a form of domestic violence. But what they do is the parent uses the child as the weapon to hurt the other person. And it is so, so wrong, because, you know, whatever about an adult being able to somehow get help and figure out domestic violence, which of course is a horrendous thing to think is happening to children and going unchecked, is terrifying.
And I would imagine among the myriad difficult things about parental alienation is for those who may be in a position to help or support the parent who has been alienated, and indeed their children, it can be difficult to separate from a bystander's standpoint the normal bitterness and animosity that may occur as part of a relationship breakdown, but also to distinguish fact from fiction, because if somebody is in the psychological position where they feel that it is appropriate to manipulate their children into a hatred of their other parent, then they're clearly able to put a spin on it to the wider public, if you will.
And that's why psychologists maintain that anyone who commits parental alienation against a child, they basically have pretty unanimously come to the conclusion that they cannot be fully functioning. They must be suffering from some kind of pathology, because it is just something which is so wrong intrinsically to do to any child. You wouldn't do it if you were thinking straight.
Now, I would imagine there's very little academic or study-based data on the prevalence or not of parental alienation in Ireland and on its ongoing ramifications and impacts on children who may be subjected to it, and indeed their other parent. What is it that Alienated Children First would like to achieve?
Oh, where would I start? I suppose the number one, the first thing on the agenda is to get it recognised. One of the problems with parental alienation is that it is an urban description of several different psychological pathologies. It is not a diagnosable disorder on its own, you know. So a psychologist can't diagnose somebody as suffering from parental alienation because their parent did this to them. It's an urban term used to describe the various things which ultimately boil down to the coercive control of a child by a parent to use it as a weapon against another parent, which is a mouthful, and it's difficult for people to get their heads around. You would, you know, in very simplistic terms, it's obvious and it's clear you shouldn't do that to a kid. But when it gets complicated, as you said there, Kira, is where, you know, people say, oh, well, there's two sides to every story, and maybe he has good reason for not letting the kids see her, or maybe, you know, or she says he was mean to the kids and she has to protect them from him, and there the waters get muddied. So what we want, first and foremost, is a clear definition of what is parental alienation. Now, we're going with the minister's definition in the Dáil for the moment, but it's not a formally recognised definition, and it's certainly not in legislation, which is something we would like to see.
In theory, and I certainly am not a solicitor or practitioner of the law, could the net effects of parental alienation, if you remove that umbrella term or that urban term that you have described it as, can not fall under coercive control legislation?
You have it in a nutshell. It can, and it does, and it should. And the coercive control legislation is in place since 2019, perfectly capable of dealing with this. However, if you go to a guard and you say, look, I'm a victim of parental alienation, my child is being coercively controlled by the mother, the legislation actually only deals with coercive control being used by one spouse against another. It doesn't cover coercive control being used against a child to hurt the other, and therefore the guards are unempowered to do anything about it. And that is one, it doesn't even need a change of the legislation. It just needs a case history to be recognised in law as clarifying the fact that coercive control of a child to use as a domestic violent weapon against another party is coercive control.
Are we far away, Ken, from that being a possibility?
No, except, and I don't doubt that there are case histories there already, but the problem with family law in Ireland is the in-camera rule and the inability for any of the parties to discuss what happens in court. So therefore, nobody gets to hear about it. Now, Alan Shatter did try and introduce legislation in 2015 with the Children and Families Act, whereby the press were allowed to go into court and cover family law cases as long as the parties remained anonymous, which we thought was fantastic. And at last we're going to get, as you said, that there is a great void in empirical data on this subject, and that would be one way we could gather some, for instance. But what has happened is that when the press do turn up to try and cover particularly toxic cases, the judges feel it's not in the kids' interest to have any media there, because they don't know what's going to be said, and they don't know whether or not somehow the child might be identified, or the journalist might say, well, this family, which shall remain not anonymous but has 72 children and lives in XYZ village, and they might be able to identify them from the 72 children. So these kinds of things, and obviously I'm speaking hypothetically there, are used by judges as a means of stopping the press getting into the more toxic cases, and therefore we still don't get to hear about them.
Well, Ken Joyce, Director and Spokesperson of Alienated Children First, thank you indeed for joining us.